What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It's Monday, which means that we will spend our full hour today on Palestine. We are joined this morning by Dr. James Smith, an emergency medical doctor in London who spent nearly 2 months treating patients in Gaza, and by Zahra Ballou, the executive director of the Bay Area Office of the Council on American Islamic Relations, or CARE. Good morning to you both. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Good morning.
So the way that I usually start Mondays is reactions from my guests on headlines. And the first headline that I begin most Mondays with is reflection or response on the numbers, which we all know is an undercount. But according to an article in Mondelez, we are at 37,347 murdered and at least 85,372 wounded in the Gaza Strip, 544 murdered in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem. We are just about 9 months into this iteration of the genocide. Zahra, when you sit with those numbers, what are you sitting with?
I was remembering this morning that we spoke in October when this had just begun. Mm-hmm. And I think the deaths were under 2,500 at that point. And it still felt, it felt tragic and horrible and yet very on brand for Israel and the United States. I continue to sit with that. Is that the whole world has watched live. And it's not to say that there have not been worse numbers in other places. It's to say that this has been the most broadcast and watched violence that we have seen. And the United States continues to supply the weapons. And so heartbroken, horrified, and doing my best to hold on to hope.
I had a guest on a few weeks ago, Tandiwe Abdullah, the daughter of Malina Abdullah, who said, and was part of the student encampments, and she said, and I cried then, and when I repeated it, I cried, we are watching a genocide on our phones. And we don't play the oppression Olympics, right? There may be worse numbers elsewhere. And 37,000 men, women, and children, majority women and children, is massive. Dr. Smith, when you hear those numbers, as someone whose goal is to preserve life, what do you sit with?
I mean, it's horrifying. And I think we need to be constantly reminded, you know, there's this tendency in public health, but also in the way that we represent violence, however it manifests worldwide, to quantify. So we speak the language of numbers, but of course I've seen the people that together comprise that number, the children, the men, the women, the elderly, and this sort of perverse situation, frankly, whereby a day that is fractionately less catastrophically violent than the day before is, then the situation drops off the media headlines for the most part, and yet we're still talking about tens of people that have been killed, whole families in many instances that have been killed together. As you rightly said, when you described the numbers as they stand today, that is a phenomenal underrepresentation of the true severity of what has happened in Palestine. And I appreciate very much that you mentioned the West Bank, because not enough people are talking about how and where the genocide is manifesting spatially. The situation in the West Bank is catastrophic and really hasn't been spoken about enough.
Yeah, we spend every Monday now covering Palestine for a lot of the reasons you just said. And we have a guest, Rahab Nizal, who's the author of Driving in Palestine, who has been in the occupied West Bank. And so we try to do our due diligence to ensure that folks understand that the genocide is happening there too, and also help folks understand that we're talking about people, you know, a lot of times will say in Gaza, but it's the Gaza Strip, right? These are many towns where this is taking place. Dr. Smith, you sort of already segued to where I wanted to go next. So many of the headlines have been about the Zionist state's intentional demolition of the healthcare system throughout the Gaza Strip, bombing hospitals, invading hospitals. You spent 2 months treating patients in the Gaza Strip. Broadly, what was that experience like? We haven't yet had a doctor on the show that could speak to witnessing the horror there.
I mean, what's happening in Gaza is certainly the most horrific thing that I have ever experienced in all my years as a physician. And I've said this to other media outlets, but even the most attentive media outlet, I think, has failed to capture just how barbaric, just how despicable what is happening is in Gaza right now. Visiting or traveling through Khan Yunis and Gaza City, I mean, the extent of the devastation there, not only to healthcare facilities, but frankly to all infrastructure that enables people to not only live, but to live with dignity, has been completely decimated. We're talking schools, bakeries, hospitals, offices, residential neighborhoods. There are parts of these large cities that have been literally flattened to the ground. To see almost the entire population of the Gaza Strip, approximately 2.1 million people, many of whom are of course already refugees that have now become internally displaced people, living in squalid makeshift camps, people living in under plastic tarpaulin in makeshift tents, and then of course this rather incredibly perverse situation, this sort of fixation on humanitarian response. And again, I've said this to other media outlets, but it's one of the things that just feels most disgusting to me, which is that we have influential states and influential in many ways, not only in large part because of the ways in which they are complicit in the genocide, who are calling for greater humanitarian access, who are fixating on the number of trucks that Israel permits to enter into Gaza, without speaking to how that situation ever came to be, how an entity like the Israeli entity can exert complete control over the conditions that enable life or hasten death for the people of Gaza. And that's really the stage that we've entered into now, that these complicit states can advocate for humanitarian access, can speak about the need to open the border for X number of trucks per day, while continuing to bankroll and militarily resource this genocidal violence. So yes, I realize I've deviated somewhat from your question, but this is in large part what I've seen. You know, a completely horrific situation with a humanitarian system that is unable to respond because the needs are phenomenally high and increase on a daily basis, and will continue to increase for as long as the violence is allowed to continue.
It wasn't a deviation. It was a more holistic response. And y'all are going to have to excuse me. I'm having an emotional reaction this morning. I did as I was prepping for the show. You know, there's a certain detachment almost that you have to have Zara, I know as an organizer, you understand to get the work done. And then sometimes that's just not possible. Zara, any responses, any response to what Dr. Smith just laid out for us?
I think the only response that comes to mind for me right now is that I wonder what our decision makers, our elected officials, even international leaders, like, what are they watching? Like, how are they not as moved as we are? Because when I'm among friends and colleagues, we all know and we all agree. How are they denying the reality on the ground? And I can't think of any answer besides they are denying the humanity of Palestinians. To know what we know and see what we see and continue to enable it only makes sense if you don't agree that these are human beings, if you don't agree that they are equal to us. And still, like, the double standard of it gets, right, collective punishment, armed resistance, like all of these things that Israel is engaging in. We say, right, in certain spaces, every accusation is a confession. And we see that every day with Israel, whether it's whether it's a question of armed resistance or collective punishment or human shields or sexual assault, every single one, day after day, turns out to be something Israel is engaging in various ways in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And so how does it continue but for a failure to acknowledge the humanity of Palestinians? And then Kat, I actually want to respond to you getting emotional, if it's okay. And it's to say that, like, yes, I know that to do this work, we have to be able to detach ourselves and we have to manage how we get emotional and when we get emotional. But there's something also about at the risk of centering those of us that are in the West, the vicarious trauma that Palestinians and their supporters are now reporting many, many months in, because how many stories can you read about, and forgive me, right? Like, the most horrific stories from last week were about trained dogs being used for sexual assault targeting Palestinian prisoners. How many of those stories can you read and still hold strong? And so I appreciate you sharing that you've been emotional. It hopefully normalizes for people that many of us are, and we're struggling to maintain our composure as we do this work.
Thank you, Sister Zara. Two things. When you talk about the only explanation for how they can see what we are seeing and continue on in this vein is that they do not see Palestinians as human. In your first response to my first question to you this morning, you said, on brand for the United States. Not seeing people of color is very much, as human beings, is very much on brand for the United States, is very much on brand for the UK. And then when you talked about the utilization of dogs, right, it's so clear to me why there's also such a movement of Black solidarity, yeah, with the Palestinian struggle. Both historically, because of what we've experienced historically and what we continue to experience in the so-called land of the free. Zara, CARE has made several demands on a tone-deaf Biden. it's just my head just like, that emoji with the exploding head? That's like my constant state of being these days. But you keep making the demands, and thank you so much. Most recently, the demand is for Biden to condemn the torture of Palestinians by Israeli forces. You started to segue into that, talking about the utilization of dogs for sexual assault. Can we start with what we know, what you know about the types of torture Palestinians are experiencing?
Oh, you know, this is where I like have to like emotionally regulate. I'm like, I'm only reading so much because I need to know, and at the same time I can't. But the thing that strikes me, you know, as I think about the examples of how prisoners have been treated, prisoners, hostages, let's call them hostages on both sides, right? Or how is when you see the images of Israeli hostages being released, they look healthy, they look happy. They still have their wits about them, despite being held for, you know, no other option in a war zone and actively witnessing a genocide. And then you look at these videos and pictures of Palestinian hostages being released by Israel. And there is this image of image and video of a young man who was released last week, and he is clearly out of his mind. He can't focus his eyes. He can't hold, he can't string enough words together for a coherent sentence. He's not walking straight because he's injured. And so that's the image I want our listeners to be looking at and thinking about, is how do the people look when they emerge? What we know about how Palestinian hostages have been treated is they are regularly starved. They are left out in the scorching heat. They are beaten and brutalized for fun. So they report that Israeli soldiers like take turns beating on them, enjoying it, like it's almost like a sport for them. They have been electrocuted, so they report being shocked repeatedly during interrogations, and again, sometimes not during interrogation. And then some of the, you know, some of the more recent, really just horrible allegations that have emerged are being forced to sit on hot metal rods as a form of sexual assault, and then more recently, the one I mentioned is dogs being trained to sexually assault them. And so we're seeing this. And I talked about, you know, the condition of the hostages that are released, the Palestinian hostages that are released, but we are also often hearing of Palestinian hostages that are being killed in Israeli custody. And so when a Palestinian hostage is taken by Israel, the family doesn't know when they will return, what Israel will do to them, and the condition that they will return in, if they return at all. And the converse is not true. When Israeli hostages are taken or have been taken in this one instance on October 7th, the biggest risk to their life is Israel itself, which has killed numerous hostages. I believe it has killed as many more hostages than it has actually freed. And again, we watch this, right? And it's hard because we keep issuing these statements from, you know, from CARE, and we've moved to calling Israeli war crimes U.S. Israeli war crimes. So it's like U.S. hyphen Israeli war crimes, because we want to be really clear that one, the U.S. could stop this with one phone call. But two, the fact that it continues is evidence of our complicity, because it's our weapons being used. Following the Rafah tent massacre and several others, Palestinians reported, like we can tell from the coding on the weapons munitions that we're finding that these originated in California, these originated in different parts of the United States. And so we're calling them U.S.-Israeli war crimes, and we're continually asking Biden to do something about them. And I, like you, agree, he is tone deaf, he is incompetent. I'm not even sure how fully present he is. The fact that he's willing to sacrifice his own reelection to let this continue should concern all of us with regard to Israeli influence in the United States. But many of us are struggling with what to do, if anything at all, or how to do it. And so speaking out and creating a historical record of the U.S. complicity is one thing all of us can do, and we are continuing to try to work on.
Dr. Smith, I know that you're an emergency room doctor, but I'm going to throw this question to you anyway. You know, Zara's talking about the mental, emotional, psychological state of Palestinians who, the ones that do actually walk out. And as Zara was talking, I started thinking about trauma, right? Mm-hmm. And generational trauma, And even if this iteration of the genocide ended today, the impact on the ability of Palestinian people to rebuild psychologically, mentally, the impact on communities and families, right? So my father was a Vietnam vet. That completely shaped the way he raised me, and that completely shaped the way I view the world. Can you speak to that at all?
I mean, for sure. We saw in almost every patient that we would see in the emergency department, there was some manifestation of traumatization. That there was no one with a physical injury or no one who was caring for someone with a physical injury or a medical problem who wasn't traumatized in some form or another. For some people, that was more outwardly visible than for others. As Zahra mentions, the really harrowing images of the young man that was released from the Israeli concentration camp is a particularly frightening example, but everybody is traumatized in some form or another. To my knowledge, there have not been, as of yet, any comprehensive sort of mental health assessments of across different communities in different parts of Gaza. But I am sure that if medical organizations were to do such screening, they would find that almost everyone, if not everyone, would be scoring for a host of severe mental health problems right now. And of course, as you mentioned, the sort of intergenerational aspects of trauma. I mean, we know this from the ways in which violence, injustice, racialized violence, racism, and so on have affected the bodies of people elsewhere in the world. You know, it is scientifically proven that trauma sort of moves in our genetics from one generation to the next. And that will, of course, have ramifications for the next generation of people living in Gaza and the generation afterwards, and indeed for many generations to come, regardless of the measures that are put in place to treat mental health problems and to try and remedy the damage done. Those consequences will manifest regardless.
Some additional things that have been revealed about the type of torture Palestinians are experiencing is also limbs being amputated and bullets being removed without anesthesia, and that doctors, folks that are supposed to do no harm, are participating in these torture sessions, right? Those would be who are amputating limbs and removing bullets with no anesthesia. As a doctor, Dr. Smith, what do you sit with when you hear that?
I mean, it's disgusting, it's despicable, and such people should have never been allowed to practice medicine, and of course should be imprisoned for the crimes that they have committed. There is nothing about the medical profession or medical practice that under any circumstances would condone this, and it is a betrayal of the discipline and of the potential of medicine and of health practice for so-called healthcare professionals to participate in violence. This isn't even complicity in violence. This is direct participation. To some extent, however, it is somewhat unsurprising. I mean, back in, I believe it was November, that there was an open letter written and signed by, I believe, at least 100 Israeli doctors who were effectively condoning and calling for attacks against Palestinian healthcare facilities. We've seen so-called ethicists and others write in very influential medical journals, many of them based in the US, but also in The Lancet and elsewhere, effectively refusing to see or to condone, rather to condemn, sorry, what Israel is doing to the Palestinian people, and in some cases trying to manipulate how we understand ethics, manipulate how we interpret the law to effectively suggest that some of these actions may be not only legal, but also morally the right thing to do. It defies comprehension. It's despicable. And the thing that also causes me even greater concern is that there hasn't been concerted, widespread indignation in the face of these things from across the global medical community. Very few royal colleges in the United Kingdom, very few influential medical associations have even taken the very basic step to call for a ceasefire, let alone to realize the full sort of liberatory potential of medicine and public health. It really brings the deepest and most profound shame to what is left of our profession.
Yeah, we've seen here in the United States doctors that do speak out. You know, and I live in the Bay Area, which is mostly progressive, and have watched doctors be terrorized by their places of employment for saying anything at all. Zara, there's another UN report that shows that the Zionist state repeatedly violated the laws of war, and it's, as it says in your press release, genocidal campaign. The UN has called it an extremist campaign. Can you break down for my listeners a little bit about what is in that report? And then I guess I have a question too about what is the utility of these reports? I mean, documentation for sure, keeping record, absolutely. Its role in organizing around the demand for a free Palestine.
Yeah. It's every time I think that we can't learn more about the horrors of what Israel is doing, we do. And, you know, and it leaves me grateful for this persistence in documentation. The most recent report looks at something many of us have seen and known for some time, and it's the use of, if it's a report that I'm thinking of, it's the use of just a level of artillery and bombs, these 2,000-pound bombs, 1,000-pound bombs on residential buildings, a school, a market, and a refugee camp. And it's, you know, it's what's wild to me is that, you know, this report is coming out in June, and it's looking at bombings from October to December. So, you know, as it's gotten worse, we will learn more. Essentially, the UN is saying, again, what we know, that Israel is not being selective or careful in how it engages in warfare. It is not targeting military infrastructure. It is very specifically targeting civilian infrastructure, and consistently harming civilians. You know, what's the impact of a report like this? For those of us that are watching on the sidelines and losing our minds, it's validating, right? But for the longer term advocacy and then for accountability, this documentary record is going to be key. One of the things that we know that genocidal regimes like Israel will also do over time is attempt to bury the evidence, burn the evidence, kill the witnesses, kill the experts. And we've seen that with the targeting of doctors and journalists. And so the more that is documented by the UN and others, the better chance we have. It's, you know, ceasefire was yesterday's request. Today's request is justice. Today's demand is justice, accountability, rebuilding. And this will move us in that direction over time.
Yes, and on that note, Israeli forces recently killed Palestinian journalist Mahmoud Qassem in Gaza City, marking the 151st journalist killed by the Zionist state since October 7th. CARE, Zara, has also condemned the systematic destruction of housing, health facilities, and water wells in Gaza by the Zionist state. So I want you to talk about that, but I also want you to talk about the fact that this is not new. It's an escalation, for sure. We've been talking on this show. I can't find the book, but there's a new book, Environmental Warfare in Gaza. So we've been talking on the show about the ways in which the Zionist state has used agriculture, the destruction of it, using wind science to ensure toxins are floated into the Gaza Strip to kill crops, the forced shifting in what Palestinians are allowed to grow and to what level they're allowed to grow, which has also had an impact on culture, mental, emotional, spiritual health, even organizing, even creating impacting a whole generation of Palestinians of a certain age whose only memory of the Gaza Strip is decimation.
Right.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
And there are Palestinians who have lived through not just this, but multiple Israeli escalations of violence, right? Somebody said this about Palestinian residents of the Gaza Strip recently, which is that all they know is war. Many are younger than us, and they've been through this time and again. As I was refreshing about the report, I found this quote. An IDF, an IOF spokesperson, was reported to have said that while balancing accuracy with the scope of damage, right now we're focused on what causes maximum damage. So they are telling on themselves. The civilian infrastructure in the Gaza Strip has been completely decimated. Hospitals have repeatedly been attacked. Schools, including UN schools, have repeatedly been attacked, despite at times that's the only place left for people to take shelter. Markets, right, both, by the way, in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Homes. Civilian homes, refugee camps, right? So some of these 2,000-pound bombs that we talk about are being dropped on tents. And, right, so it's not only that they're making the conditions on the ground unlivable, it's that they are making life for the people there unbearable, right? So many children have lost one or more limbs, and so many children have lost one or more parents. They're nearly daily videos of children emerging without any parents, anywhere to be found. And this is, you know, this is why it's important to say that, like, this didn't begin 9 months ago, that this is Israel's strategy. Is when we look at the maps, Israel has time and again expanded by stealing Palestinian land. And we know that that is their hope and intention here, is make the conditions on the ground unlivable. But the thing that gets me about this is that they're also not letting Palestinians out. And, you know, Palestinians are stuck in this catch-22 of, I don't want to leave my ancestral homeland because I know I will never be permitted back. I know what happened in 48. I know what happened in 67. And the moment I leave, I'm never coming back. But for those who are making that decision, getting out is a near impossible feat also. If you can get safe passage, if you can make it to an open border crossing, and if you can scrounge up a minimum of $5,000 to $7,000 per person to get out, then maybe you can get out. And so it's long before October 2023, the Gaza Strip had been designated the world's largest open air prison. And that is what it continues to be, but it's maybe the world's largest open-air torture chamber.
Dr. Smith, increasingly we are hearing about the crisis of starvation, right? So we talk a lot about the people that are bombed, shot, etc. but people are literally dying of starvation. And I'm wondering if you can actually walk us through what starvation does to the body. And at this point, at the stage of starvation that thousands of Palestinians are at, including elderly and children, what is the road to recovery? It's like when we're talking about the United States dropping boxes of food, sometimes on the heads of Palestinians, the futility, actually, of that, because what they really need is a longer process, yes?
Right. I mean, I think the first thing to say with respect to starvation is that this is a process that doesn't happen overnight. This is a drawn-out, painful, horrific experience of slowly being starved to death. Now, in the context of hunger, undernutrition, starvation, combined with the catastrophic spread of infectious diseases, diarrhea, jaundice syndrome, which is most likely an indication of hepatitis A, respiratory problems, all sorts of other conditions and diseases that are spreading because people are in cramped, unsanitary conditions, or are being rather sort of corralled into such small spaces. That is a recipe for disaster, and that is, of course, exactly the disaster that we're seeing now, the manufactured disaster that we're seeing now. You're absolutely right to say that the aid drops are not a solution for a whole host of reasons. As I mentioned earlier, the incredibly perverse situation whereby you've got the states that are enabling, or rather enacting, violence, who are then also titrating small amounts of humanitarian aid. And this sort of titration mechanism has been documented in relation to Gaza, predating, of course, October of last year, whereby, of course, the Israeli entity maintained complete control over all of the borders into and out of Gaza, including, of course, the border with Egypt, where they were able to exert political pressure to ensure that certain people didn't enter or leave and certain things didn't enter or leave. Starvation is something that I have seen. I have seen children in particular starving. But of course, the things that you don't necessarily see visibly, hunger, the sort of progression of undernutrition, these are all things that are incredibly pervasive and that are not captured with this sort of terminology. And I think, again, these sort of what we're seeing now in Gaza really has only further exposed the limitations of the language of humanitarianism, these arbitrary thresholds that are in place that trigger some form of humanitarian response. X number of or X percentage of people need to die every day in order to reach a crisis threshold. X number of children between 6 and 59 months need to have a middle upper arm circumference of less than X millimeters in order to be severely acutely malnourished, and only then does that trigger some form of humanitarian indignation. But the situation, or rather the steps that need to be that you need to go through in order to reach such a state, are such that you have watched a population become progressively more and more malnourished until you say, okay, enough is enough now. You know, we need to do something to reach the point where you have not only risk of starvation, but people actively starving. You have watched and you have done nothing, or you have done far too little prior to reaching such a moment.
We have just about 2 minutes left, and Zara, I want to turn to you for final thoughts.
I know that Palestine will be free. I know that we will look back and remember who was on the right side of history and who wasn't. And the only time better to call for a ceasefire, for rebuilding, and for justice than today was yesterday. And so I invite people who are listening who, you know, haven't spoken up yet to do something, to say something, because it's the only way. And I want to be able to look back and say to my children and my grandchildren that I did the most I could. Otherwise, what's left?
All right. I want to thank you both so much for joining me this morning. You, Dr. Smith, I believe it's evening where you're at. Thank you very much for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world for all of us to thrive in. That's it for this episode, fam. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programming is funded exclusively by listeners. If you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. Remember, we all we got.